If I can just mention for one more second, we've got a really great event next week on Wednesday, the 23rd, where we're featuring Max Van Cleek from the Computer Science Department here at Oxford, and also Nick Carey from Blockchain. He's the founder and president of Blockchain. So he's going to give a talk at Saeed. We'll give you more details later.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, Nick is good people.
He's coming to Saeed. Lecture Theater 5, 1 Park Street, 5:30 p.m. Wednesday the 23rd.
Excellent. I might even come up for that.
You should.
23rd. Day before Thanksgiving?
Yes.
On Wednesday?
Yeah.
Next week. Cool. All right. So, let us wade in. Governing at light speed versus governing at horse speed. So, the basic kind of maximum speed at which your society is capable of communicating with itself is a critical variable, and as that critical variable changes, everything in your society either changes or becomes decadent, hate-filled, and evil. You could tell this is a post-Trump perspective. So this is kind of new material. One of the reasons that I always record what I do and then stick it online is that it stops me repeating myself. It forces me to develop new material, because otherwise I'm just going to say the same thing over and over and over again, and people would be like, yeah, we heard it on the tape. If you're interested in learning how to do, you know, public speaking, generally effective communications, the best Gondam book in the world is called Christ Was an Ad Man, written by an alcoholic atheist in the 1970s or early 1980s, one of the original advertising executives in the golden period of American advertising. It is the best book on human communication ever written, and I'm increasingly convinced after using it for 20 years that it's the best book on clear thinking ever written. Christ Was an Ad Man. I've given away like 30 copies of it in the last 10 years. And what Pritikin says is this, right? If you want to change somebody's mind, you have to wait until they're ready to make a decision, and then you have to give them facts which are pertinent to the decision they're going to make, and you have to not lie to them, either by omission or commission. And that turns out to be a really sound basis for constructing arguments, and it's very different from the kind of dialectical model where you win an argument by convincing somebody that they're wrong. Pritikin's approach is you wait until they're ready to make a decision, and then you give them the facts that they need to make the decision in the direction you want them to go. This implies that you have to be right? And it means that you have to tell the truth, but it also means that you're not forcing people to do things before they're ready. And this is a very different thing from our standard models of intellectual debate that are very fundamentally gladiatorial. So the idea that you can have intellectual communication that's about decision-making and about choice rather than about model building and model breaking has been a really interesting kind of intellectual tool in my arsenal. And I really recommend, you know, grabbing that and pulling as much cultural value as possible out of it. Pritikin also claims to be the guy that named Google, which is another story in and of itself. So second tip is, if you want to do this kind of stuff, record everything you do, watch it 3 times, you will hate it for the first 5 years, then you'll start getting better. After 10 years, you'll be good. After 15 years, people will be like, oh my God, you're so talented. No, it's just practice. But you don't get an effective closing of the feedback loop unless you watch your own tape. And you really want video rather than just audio, because picking up the stuff that you're doing that is annoying the audience is way easier if you can watch your body language, because you can see yourself stiffen, you can see yourself tense, you can really know the places where you're screwing up. So that will conclude the metadata layer. Right, so governing at light speed versus governing at horse speed. Society that we currently have is built on a platform of 4-year electoral democracy and gold. Right? 4-year electoral democracy, the idea was that you'd have representatives that would ride on a horse to London, to Washington, would stay there most of the time for 4 years. They might go back a couple of times to see their families if their families lived at the other end of the country. But they would basically go away, they'd make decisions for the people back home, how they could still remember what the people back home looked like, and then eventually they'd go back home and you'd never see them again. Right? That sort of structure for our decision making has gone basically unchanged about 400 years. We get trains, we get planes, we get telegraph, we get railways, we get cars, and all of those innovations dramatically reduce the length of time that it takes to send a signal from the people back home to the big city where they make all the decisions and steal all the money. And that fundamental variable has probably changed by, I don't know, a factor of 100,000 by now, more, I mean, how much faster is the speed of light than a horse? Might be a million, might be 10 million. We could work it out, right? But the idea that you could change a fundamental variable that affects the core structure of your society by a factor of maybe 10 million and not change the mechanisms by which your society makes decisions is obviously totally absurd. And the only reason you'd wind up in that position is if the people running your society hugely profited by pretending that society ran at the speed of a horse. So you have a very slow-moving, anti-egalitarian elite who profit from horse-speed artifacts. And if you look around society and search for horse-speed artifacts, there are tons of them. I'm sure we'll mention a few more of them as we go through. I'm sure we could make a list of them right now. But there are a ton of these things. Right? And the reason that they're still there, even though everything else is in freefall, is because they form effective places where people can generate and maintain power structures that allow them to tax. And I don't mean this in a very literal sense of literally raising taxes. I also mean this in the sense of things like natural monopolies and what Ivan Illich calls radical monopoly. So a radical monopoly is something like a profession like architect, where you're only allowed to be an architect and build buildings if you've had 7 years of training as mandated by the state. And the creation of a caste, which has a special empowerment, and you're not allowed to build your own houses, even if you're competent, you're not allowed to do it. It's not about the thing which is performed. It's a magical attribute attached to the person who performs it. That radical monopoly is an unseen property right. So we typically think of intellectual property as being copyright, patent, trademark, but it's copyright, patent, trademark, and professional certification. And those monopolies are astonishingly damaging to the normal skill base of society because it means that ordinary people who are talented don't just do as much as they can and then call a professional for help. They're not allowed to even take a try because if they do, it's illegal and their house will be torn down. You know, if you do, for example, minor medical procedures on your kitchen table, you will be arrested very quickly even if you're competent, right? And this sounds like a joke, but imagine how different society would be if most villages had somebody who could do, you know, minor medical in a pretty casual way and were fairly good at it. You know, you mangle one of your fingers in a car door and you take it around there and they figure out whether it's broken or not. That sort of notion that you've got a kind of community willingness to have a try at things gets washed out in the age of radical monopoly and it turns into a de-skilling of society. Right. So what I want to try and illustrate here is that the horse speed institutions are now decadent, corrupt, and evil. Right? Are any of the professions actually doing the best that is capable with the technology available on behalf of the people that they purport to help? Has medicine fundamentally changed in terms of your interaction with the medical system in 30 or 40 years? Right? I mean, for those of us that are old enough to have an opinion about that, the answer is probably no. The equipment has gotten a lot better, but things like preventative medicine are still completely invisible on the radar. Imagine what you could do with the UK National Health Service if it was a preventative medicine machine that used big data to figure out what lifestyle trends would produce a healthy population, and then used all this nudge stuff to try and elicit those behaviours from the population without having to do a kind of tax and spend approach. Right? And the reason that's not happening is the radical monopoly granted to doctors by the state enables them to practice medicine, which is a different thing from enabling them to keep the population healthy. And in an environment where the welfare state is in deep trouble, the idea that the medical franchise isn't about treating illness rather than about maintaining wellness turns out to have massive pervasive long-term impacts. Does anybody know what the biggest single killer is of people around the world? The number one cause of all death? Bloody tobacco. Right? All the years that I was working on disaster relief, I had to ask myself, why am I not working on tobacco eradication? Right? Clearly it affects far more people, clearly it's far more fundamental. How many of you know intelligent, promising young people that smoke? Right? How many of you are intelligent, promising young people that smoke? Right? Knock that shit off. Right? And look at the e-cigarette thing. We could have had those 30 years ago. The technology is not new, the batteries are a lot better, blocked by tobacco monopolies. So what I want to illustrate here is the structure of society is filled with decadent, corrupt, evil institutions which hang on to horse-speed reality in an environment where we actually have light speed reality, right? This horse speed fantasy world, which is kind of pulled over our eyes. The Matrix is not produced by, you know, hyper-intelligent space aliens, as far as I can tell. The Matrix is largely produced by corrupt old people that have some kind of natural monopoly that they've managed to get a handle on and are maintaining. The Matrix is monopoly consciousness, and society as you experience it is an interlocking network of monopolies, which is why it's so hard to get a break. Now, into this comes, boom, the Lightspeed community. And the Lightspeed community, I suspect, have always clustered around whatever the latest form of communications technology was. I bet that the people that ran the Penny Post, that were building this, you know, super network for intellectual communication that would, you know, hugely empower knowledge workers in rural areas and all the rest of that stuff, I bet they had exactly the same personality characteristics as today's telecoms hackers. Right? I bet that they were essentially programmers, right? The people that were programming Jacquard looms, you know, okay, it's all software. Telegraph, right? The sort of secret communitarian network of telegraph operators, when there was nothing to do, they would practice their Morse code by sitting there tapping messages to each other. They'd build friendship networks that went all over the country, all over the world. Because, you know, the wires were there, they were wide open, the operators could do anything they like. Does that not sound a lot like IRC? Right? So at this kind of productive edge where new communications technology comes into society, you get this culture of people that are moving faster than the world around them. And those people tend to be disproportionately bright, intellectually flexible, and communitarian. Often to a fault. So this kind of dialogue between revolutionary new technology and the horse speed universe, which is, by the way, a thin layer over the kind of caveman territorial dominance thing, which is the feudal land rights system that we still operate. All of that sort of stuff is the reason that we keep inventing fantastic technologies and completely fail to produce fantastic culture. Right? If you go back to the 1950s and look at the projections about what society will be like when they have a thing which is equivalent to the internet, everybody is going to work from home, everybody is going to be rich, everybody is going to be super educated, everything is going to be amazing. Do we have the potentiality to do that now? Yes. Is it what we did? No, we did TaskRabbit. Right? You know, slavery as a service. So that sort of model, right, is produced by the capture of the potentiality of light speed culture by horse speed thinking. So you come along with some technology that has the power to fundamentally liberate from physical constraints, which is fundamentally the purpose of all technology. It lifts us above our biology into a world where we have things like clean hands, shoes, and it takes these potentials and then uses them to maintain the monopolies which are characteristic of the kind of horse speed universe. And this brings us around to our old friend, gold. So somewhere in my pockets, if I'm lucky, there might be a pound. And normally in my wallet, I carry a big 2 ounce American silver coin minted by some libertarian weirdos, but unfortunately I don't have it today. However, I can use this. Just remember, I do actually have precious metal. So it'd be better if this was silver, but we'll just have to work with it. So on this thing, right, £1. If I looked at a pound note, on the pound it would say, promise the page bearer, pay the bearer £1. Does anybody know what it was a pound of? Right? The pound used to be redeemable for a pound of?
Silver.
Silver, right? So you could go to the bank and you could retrieve physical metal, and the note was a promissory note against a physical metal reserve. And governments were constrained to have physical metal to the weight of the currency that they issued, because it was a thing called the gold standard. All of the paper tokens were backed by physical metal sitting in big boxes. Right? The mint. What do they call it in the States? Fort Knox. Right? There was physical goddamn metal behind all of the transactions. And this was what prevented inflation. The governments could not simply print money if they did not have the gold. They could not spend the gold. They could spend from their savings, they could spend from their reserves, but they couldn't decouple the instruments by which value was measured from the underlying value that was being represented. because there was no way to inflate a currency when the currency was backed by physical metal. Now, when did we go off the gold standard?
1932.
Right? Very recently. 72, right? Different countries, I think, did it at slightly different times. Bretton Woods and all the rest of that malarkey. It's right around the time when I was born, right? Since then, the rate of inflation has gone through the roof and currencies have been devalued by factors of 1,000 to 10,000, even for good currencies. So the total sense of freefall that you feel in society is because the underlying yardstick of value from literally prehistory got yanked out from under us 40 years ago, and the entirety of society has been in free fall ever since. Now, I am not a gold bug. I don't think that going back to gold will solve all of our problems, but a lot of the total sense of disorientation and chaos that we feel is that human culture evolved where money was actually worth something and it didn't matter what the government said, metal was metal. And once you move away from that as a yardstick of value, it's basically like having the days of the week randomly redefined and the years have variable lengths, right? The government says that this year, 1987, will be 14 months long and each month will have 56 days and you were expected to like it. Imagine trying to be a historian in a world where the government simply lengthens the year every time they need more things to happen inside of an electoral period. Right? The fundamental distortion of an axis by which we measure reality to stretch the yardstick to make what you want to become true into the truth is 1984 incarnate. And this is what happens when we decouple from the gold standard. Governments lose all restraint and reality becomes elastic in ways that reality has never been elastic. An ounce of gold would buy you a good pair of shoes and a handmade suit in Rome at its peak and in London today. It's maintained value to within about that ratio of goods in the real world for the entire period. Maybe I am becoming a gold bug. Goes to being an idiot. So, is everybody clear why we are talking about all this stuff before we get to blockchains? Right? So, the blockchain, Bitcoin, right, in its first instantiation, is a light-speed implementation of the thing which was useful about gold. So it takes the utility of gold in a horse speed world as an immovable unit of account, a yardstick of value, and it takes that property and it implements it in a way which is compatible with light speed, the light speed universe. And this is staggeringly radical. It's so radical that people have been talking about it for 10 years and they still cannot effectively communicate to ordinary people how radical it is. Blah, 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 right? I mean, it's just, the explanations are crap. Even my explanation is crap, right? And part of this is because the best explanation for Satoshi is that he is actually a time traveler from the future who just came back with a set of patches for reality, right? I mean, I worked in crypto all the way through the 1990s. There's no bloody way any human did that. Oh, you know, it's like a summation of everything that we knew about cryptography and computer science in a single piece of software that shipped close enough to bug-free that it could hold value from day one. That's absurd, right? So, you know, the kind of religious fascination that people have with Satoshi and with that early work, I don't think that is necessarily misplaced, right? There's another talk that I do, you know, sometimes where I talk about Newton basically being the smartest guy in the world. Does somebody want to let that guy in? Come in, come in, you haven't missed anything. So, you know, I used to talk about, you know, it wasn't unusual for the smartest people in the world to be the people responsible for dealing with currency. Right, Newton, right, did all of that physics stuff that we remember him for and then went off to run the mint. You know, yeah, you've done enough mathematics, go and do something useful, figure out how to do this money stuff. In that sense, you could think of Newton as basically being the first quant, right? Trained as a physicist, winds up running the banking system. This is not a new trend. So, back to the meat, right? We have light-speed potentiality and technology, we have horse-speed governance. Gold is the fundamental emblem of horse-speed governance. You could take an astonishing amount of value, pack it onto a horse, surround it with men with big stabby things made of iron, and then you can walk it across country, and then you can buy an army with it and go and sack your neighbours. Right? You know, gold could immediately be turned into liquid power of any kind that you liked, and the conversion of gold into liquid violence was astonishingly efficient. Right, the war chest was literally a big box filled with we can hire people and get them to go kill each other. And it was a thing that the king had. Okay, let's open the war chest. What do we have in here? 75 kilos of gold. That's enough to take over Germany. Right. And this was how the game ran. So along comes this decoupling of value from underlying instruments. Now, if a government wants to mount a war, what they do is they print enough currency to hire armies and to build weapons, and because they're inflating the currency, the rest of the value in the economy shrinks. Right? The government needs more time to do a job, so it puts two additional days in the week, and everybody gets paid for the same number of days they were working already. That's what inflation would look like if you did it to time rather than to value. Imagine how weird it would be if the length of your week changed when the government needed more economic productivity. That's what happens. They just call it monetary policy. So we go along and we invent this light speed unit of value, the Bitcoin. Now, I'm not in any way, shape or form a Bitcoin fundamentalist, right? I do not believe that Bitcoin will be worth $10,000 a coin. I don't believe it will be worth $100,000 a coin, which a lot of people believe. I think that the technology that it is built on is getting old, and that there's an enormous need for innovation in that space, but it's very hard to combine innovation and the maintenance of a natural monopoly, so it's not clear to me what happens in the environment where there would be a constant need for innovation, but Bitcoin is unable to innovate because the governance structures around things like the Bitcoin Foundation are so crap that they are unable to upgrade the protocol at a reasonable rate of knots. So this is not an argument for Bitcoin, it is an argument that a post-Bitcoin thing may well wind up running the world, but we're not there yet, right? Bitcoin either evolves extremely rapidly into some post-Bitcoin wonderland, or Bitcoin winds up as a footnote in history and somebody else builds a new system. But imagine if governments could no longer inflate as a way of changing reality. Now, right now, governments are not inflating. They haven't been inflating for a long time. They discovered inflating was bad. They stopped inflating. Now they're deflating. Oh, we shrunk the money one way too fast, now we're going to zoom it back up again by having negative interest rates where you put your money into a bank and the bank charges you money for keeping it there. You see what I'm saying, right? There is a fundamental problem that all the constants are variables. So what would happen if we had this kind of static unit of account? Well, a static unit of account that is backed by nothing is just an arbitrary human agreement, and it will almost certainly be renegotiated at some point. What if the static unit of account was emission of carbon into the atmosphere? Right? Human race as a whole gets to emit, say, 1 billion tons of carbon a year, whatever the number is. Does anybody know the number of sustainable carbon emissions? We'll call it 1 billion tons a year, but I'm sure it's something different. So you can emit 1 billion tons a year, and if you emit any more than that, the world gets worse for everybody, which is the equivalent of inflating the currency. You then issue every human being, by birthright, the right to emit, you know, human population, you know, 1 billion over a human population of 7 billion. So everybody gets to emit a seventh of a ton of carbon. And then that becomes a tradable energy quota that you can exchange with other people for goods and services. The people that have high-value lifestyles have to give you money in exchange for your carbon allocation, which allows them to run the high-value lifestyle. You get basic income, you get respect for fundamental ecological limits, and you get a restraint on the ability of governments to manipulate the value of money to get their political ends met. We're done. That was it. No, but do you see how simple that seems? Right? What do you need? You need the ability to make sure that no human being claims 2 shares. You need a trustworthy estimate of how much carbon the human race can emit, and you need to be able to issue tokens on some kind of post-blockchain thing, which is fast enough to handle economic transactions at that level of scale. Does that all sound fairly straightforward? Sounds pretty straightforward to me, right? So, you know, these things are really quite within reach. They're not distant and over the horizon. They are potentially the only tractable solution to the problems that we have in managing the world's economy as it currently stands. So, the theory, the practice. Does anybody have a really comfortable, easy, good grip on how blockchains work that they can explain to regular-ish people? One-ish. Okay. So I'm going to give you mine, which is only really going to work for fairly smart, regular-ish people, but by the end of it, they really understand what's happening. Are we definitely sure that is recording? Because I really want to make sure we get this on tape, and let's make sure I'm in field of view if I wander over here. Oh, very good. Great. Instinct. So, all of this blockchain stuff exists because of the speed of light. All this blockchain stuff exists because of the speed of light. If the speed of light was a meter a second, or the speed of the propagation of the signals that carry the blockchain was a meter a second, the blockchain would be super easy to understand, and you could run it in a space the size of this room, and everybody would understand what was happening. So you've got to think about slow propagation of signal, right? Think of me as being a tortoise messenger carrying word of an event from over there to over here. Right? And eventually I will reach where I'm going, and I will give the document to somebody, and they'll give me another document, and I'll turn around and go back the other way. Right? And this is what light speed is like compared to computation inside of modern computers. Right? The processor inside of your computer is maybe a centimeter across. The light has to zip backwards and forwards across that centimeter maybe 50,000 times to do some computation. So 50,000 centimeters is, what, 50 meters, something like that? Half a kilometer? It's not very far. Right? How far enough it is. I should really know these things, but I'm dyslexic, I kind of forget them. So compare that half a kilometer to the length of time that it takes for the signal to get to New York and back. New York and back takes something like a seventh of a second or a tenth of a second, whereas the half a kilometer takes whatever it is, a couple of tenth of a millisecond. And what that means is that if I'm transacting with somebody that is close to me, I can transact with them 1,000 times by the time the signal has gone as far as Berlin, and 10,000 times by the time the signal has gone as far as New York and all the way home again. So if you had a bunch of people trading some Bitcoin-like thing in Oxford, you could have exchanged value 1,000 times between 1,000 different people by the time the fact that the same value had been sent off to LA registered on the network. And by that point, recovering the original value was likely to be impossible, because it's been spent through so many hands and split up into so many pieces, that actual recovery, except by some kind of technical means, is going to become impossible. So the reason that we do the block in blockchain is that we take a unit of time and we snap it off at both ends. Anything that happens prior to this unit of time, we will ignore. Anything that happens post this unit of time, we will ignore. We're only interested in this unit of time. There is a previous unit of time, which is cast in iron. We're never going to change it. That's the previous block. In this block, we're going to assemble all of the transactions. We're going to put them in a canonical ordering. And then we're going to tell everybody that we did it, and that will be the history. Now, this is a simplification, but this is also accurate. Right? The simplification is blocks are actually hypothetical for a while. They're speculative. But you could treat them as being concrete, and then we will get to the speculative part. So we want to assemble a canonical ordering of all of the transactions in a 10-minute window. And the simple way of doing that is we write down all the transactions in the 10-minute window. The problem is, not everybody gets the transactions at the same time. So if you happen to live in, say, the North Pole, and you issue a bunch of transactions right at the edge of one of these 10-minute windows, they reach Finland pretty quickly, and you in Finland get the transaction. They don't reach Australia until the next 10-minute block, so there's a disagreement about which side of the block they're in, and it cannot be reconciled because everybody sees the transactions which reach them in their own order, in their own way, because everything is happening in a relativistic environment. Right? All of this stuff drops out relatively.
everybody's looking at the world from their own reference frame. The speed of light is an absolute horizon on what they can see. So for me, the transaction did arrive in time to be in block number three. For you, it arrived afterwards, it's in block number four. And we can never reconcile that because both accounts of reality are completely true. It's an irreconcilable difference in our perspectives generated by physics. So to handle that physical irreconcilable recounting of the truth problem, physics prevents us from agreeing on the truth because physics dictates the truth is different for all of us depending on what signals have reached us. To handle that, we have to find some way of deciding whose perspective is correct for the formation of the block. And we do that by racing computers. Everyone gets their computer, they race them by having them do lots of calculations very quickly, they hold up proof of the calculations, we assemble all of those proofs, and then we randomly pick somebody depending on how fast they ran in the race. It's a very, very simple protocol. We then pick that person and say, right, your prize is 25 bitcoins and you get to build the next block. I, as that person, then say, right, I am going to be over here building block four. I'm going to take all the transactions that I saw, I'm going to assemble them into an order that pleases me, I'm then going to publish that block to everybody else, and once everybody else has seen it, we will go ahead and we'll build block five. And that's the protocol inside of Bitcoin. To handle the relativistic nature of human experience limited by the speed of communications, we quantize time into blocks, and then these blocks become the units with which we build our history. And in horse reality, we call those blocks four-year parliamentary terms. See what I'm saying? Right? We deal with the limits on our communication system by quantizing time. The last time we quantized time, communication happened at the speed of horses, and as a result, we had to manage the problem in an effective way. Right? There was no way that we could really handle the stresses and strains of running the civil society in an environment where you had anarchy. So we created temporary centralization, four-year units. Everybody put their time and attention and energy into forming those four-year units by sending their delegates, and that parliament was essentially a block of history. Bitcoin blocks 10 minutes because it's running in the modern world. Parliamentary blocks 4 years because they're running in the horse world. And they solve the same problem, which is signal propagation requires temporary centralization, and it requires fixed endpoints and start points in time. And that worked. Right. Is there water in here somewhere? There's some glasses here for us. Oh, there's water down here. There's water! Is this all basically making sense? Desperate measures when you get this much computer science mixed into your political theory. It's even worse the other way around. Now, let's deal with the speculative nature of blocks. In actual fact, because of the imprecise nature of networks and things like network splits, it's quite hard to be absolutely sure that only one person is elected to form the next block. So we got block number three, we go on to block number four, the internet is having a bad day, and you wind up with Australia partitioned off. The Australians basically say, well, we got to keep on keeping on, so we're just going to make a block and we're going to continue to work. And everybody else on the internet has a different opinion about what happened because they've got a block which is everybody except Australia. And any kind of reasonable computer scientist would look at this problem and say, well, the obvious answer is that we have to reconcile these blocks with each other to make block number six, and we'll just take all the transactions which are non-conflicting and we'll assemble them into a kind of meta block and blah, 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 blah. And Satoshi is just like, I've already worked four miracles for you. I'm not doing six. No. In the event that Australia forms its own block and they are out of contact with the rest of the network, we're just going to dump all of their transactions and they can spend the money again if they want to.
And that approach is called eventual consistency, aka sod you, it's your problem. And eventual consistency turns out to be, frankly, the best piece of engineering in Bitcoin, because it takes a horrendous number of awfully complicated sort of edge cases and corner cases where you get really nasty interactions between the nature of physical law and the defined political characteristics of the system. It takes all of those clashes and it throws them away. I don't care, it's not my problem. If it's all screwed up, we are doing it again. Right? And that approach is a kind of pragmatism that we have not seen since, for example, regular expressions, or the original kind of division of reality into the Unix tools. Right? You know, there shall be cat, there shall be LS, there shall be, you know, whatever it happens to be. This idea of small pieces loosely joined, this kind of primitivist brute force and ignorance approach turns out to be a fundamentally good design pattern in computer science and complex systems. Right? Prefer simple algorithms in complicated cases. Even if the behavior is wrong, it is better to be predictably wrong than unpredictably correct. Because if you're predictably wrong, you know, you can identify errors, but if you're unpredictably correct, when you're not correct, the failover mechanisms just to detect the problem are worse than the original problem. This is really dating me here, but anybody that's ever seen errors coming out of something like ML, but it's got a type inference problem, you know, I guess it would be Haskell these days, but I'm guessing the error messages are as bad as they ever were. You know, 68 pages of type inference errors. Right, good. I'm glad that hasn't gone away. And note the similarity with when you do an SQL join, and the SQL join doesn't have enough narrowing off of dimensions, and you get this huge spew of stuff that comes out of it. You know, there are these kind of isomorphisms that you see again and again and again. Right, let's get back to this horse and light thing. So, the eventual consistency thing turns into many, 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 many speculative blocks which are generated that are rapidly eliminated from the system. And if you are feeling paranoid, you wait for 6 blocks or 10 blocks or 50 blocks. And at that point, the improbability that the system will be rolled back over again into an alternate state is so high that to all intents and purposes, you have finality of settlement, you have been paid, it is signed, sealed, delivered, and it would require an astonishing amount of computation to redo it. And the Bitcoin network is big enough and fast enough that that astonishing amount of computation is plausibly beyond the reach of the NSA. Plausibly. Not saying it is, but it's plausibly beyond the reach of the NSA. Shame that all of the computer power is in China. Probably not beyond a rubber hose attack from the Chinese government. Hopefully it doesn't come to that. Now, hard part. This was all fairly easy so far. Now we get to the difficult part. To understand what's wrong in the world, you know, to really get this deep sense of what is wrong, you know, why is the world this way, you know, how did we wind up in this mess, you have to get outside of the existing frameworks of historical analysis. Right? Why is the world this messed up is a question that everybody has been approaching from every angle. And we haven't had a coherent answer to that question since Marx, right? And that answer was coherent, and it turns out that when you compile the code, it detonates the nuclear power station that your computer is closest to, right? Everybody that's attempted to compile and run Marxism has wound up with genocide. It's a really, really bad anti-pattern, right? Ransomware. Problem. So now we exist in a space where we turn out not to have anything resembling an alternative to hypercapitalism, where hypercapitalism essentially is simply the law of the jungle. Right? The naked evolutionary imperative of competition of human against human being, using markets to take the violence out of the system and displace it to places at the edge of the map where the violence can be done by professionals rather than being played out by amateurs. Right? The Macintosh that you use, you know, the Lenovo that you use, is produced by people who live under authoritarian socialism, and the raw materials that go into it are harvested from the earth by people that live under, you know, armed militant feudalism. Feudalism,
socialism, hyper-capitalism in a single supply chain. The goods change political system at the borders, and in fact, we are all embedded in this network. And we are at the extreme concentration of wealth at the end of that network. This system used to be called colonialism. I don't know what you call it now. When I'm talking about history, I say the Norman conquest never ended. Right? The Normans conquered England, then Wales, Scotland, North America, South America, Africa, India, China. Then they circle all the way back around again, and today we call them the lawyers. It's a single crusade that's lasted for 1,000 years to extract raw materials and turn them into concentrated wealth in the hands of the elites. The entire thing is land piracy. So I want to suggest that there is a fix. And the fix is that we bring everything within reach up to light speed. Now, if you have a horse-speed bureaucracy versus a light-speed bureaucracy, which one is going to win, assuming that there's a level playing field? I would suggest that it will always be the light-speed bureaucracy, because it will have total knowledge of the horse bureaucracy's activities weeks before the horse bureaucracy knows what's happening, and it can therefore cut their supply chains, raid their villages, or whatever else it takes to win. Right? Advantageous accumulation of information should allow us to understand what's happening well enough that we can disable our enemies. In the environment that we're in, we have clearly got an imperative, economically and politically, to monitor everything. Has everybody seen the superstructure finally went through? Right? A year's worth of logs. A year's worth of logs of everything that you do online. Right? Sitting in the hands of the dark state. So, what percentage of your future politicians will turn out to have had some set of experiences online that, if they were widely known, would render them as being perceived as unfit to govern? Anybody with a fetish, anybody who had a really bad relationship meltdown, anybody that was mentally ill, and there are probably half a dozen sectors where you could have a set of experiences that would be recorded in the logs, which would render you, from the perspective of the public, unfit to govern. And what that means is that the secret state will have the ability to weed out 20 or 30% of the politicians they don't like with a single hint. Right? Does anybody feel comfortable with the secret state having that kind of reach into our political processes? I don't think anybody is comfortable with that. But it's not really clear what we do about it. And I don't have a canned solution for it either. Because at the end of the day, we generally speaking as a society demand complete protection from risk at the same time as we would also like total privacy. And I don't see any way that we can square those imperatives. So the secret state follows the privacy imperative because it suits it, but it is not as if we do not demand protection from terrorism. And if the price of that is surveillance, most of us will not pay. This is a social settlement. It is not fascism. It's something that democracy produces as a product. Democracy. So, within the next 10 or 20 years, we're going to get Internet of Things, and we're going to get instrumented supply chains, we're going to get quantified self, we're going to get attention monitoring, we're going to get virtual reality, we're going to get augmented reality, we're going to get, smart dust, robots that work, and a whole bunch of other stuff, right? In that environment, building a more or less accurate one-to-one representation of the physical world inside of computers seems fairly doable. Right? Certainly, you could have a little robot that flies around the university and counts the chairs and makes sure they're not broken. That's pretty easy. Right? You could have something that goes around and checks that your light bulbs are okay, if the light bulbs themselves don't tell you that they're breaking. Hey, I'm not pinging anymore. Bye. Okay. You could seriously monitor crops that were relatively homogeneous. If you had better AI and better optics, you could monitor jungles that were non-homogeneous. Right? You don't have to see like a state in this kind of rigid, dumb way. There's a book about seeing like a state. You don't have to look at the world in that rigid, dumb way if you've got AI to help you master the complexity of the world. So my suggestion is that we're going to take a scale model of the world and we're going to pull it inside of our computers over the next 10 or 20 years. If we allow that scale model of the world to be used to maintain horse-speed power structures, we are very, very, very seriously screwed. Because we're going to wind up with perfect panopticon surveillance with total knowledge of the environment being used to maintain millennia-old monopolies over land and religion. Right? You know, we don't have a land register in the UK. There's an enormous amount of land that nobody really knows who owns. Who are these people? How much land do they own? Why can't we tax them? Interesting. Old nobility that just have large packets of land that they were given by old kings, and they've held it in the family ever since, and they've got a set of deeds that are written on parchment. That kind of stuff is potentially a lot of the UK's land mass. It could be 10 or 40%. How would we ever know? Who are the ultimate beneficial owners? So, we pull the world into our computers, we build a map of everything. If that map is accurate enough that it can be used for economic and political decision making, and it's open and accessible enough that ordinary people can use it, there is a decent chance that we will replace all of the horse speed monopolies with light speed monopolies relatively quickly. And the light speed monopolies have a bad habit of collapsing into markets, because if they're in an unregulated space, it's very hard to maintain the monopoly tax for very long. Generally speaking, all that stabilizes a monopoly is regulation. Most of the stuff that's happening at light speed is so confusing to the horse guys that they can't figure out how to effectively regulate. Right? Lawyers are very poor at dealing with things like the cap theorem. It's really not their department. So if the world is increasingly run on the cap theorem and there are responses to the cap theorem, if it's increasingly run at light speed with various mechanisms for compensating for relativity, then you wind up with most of the political decision making being referent to software rather than to law. And that possibility of a transfer of authority because of the economic power that the light speed team has over the horse speed team, turning into economic and then political power, is the possibility for escape from history into a world where society works in the way that our technology would allow it to work, rather than in the way that it has always worked. Does this make sense as a set of principles? Okay, so I'm going to take a break for a minute just to let my brain cool, drink a little more water, and then we'll get through the conclusion. Are we still taping? Is it still working?
I'm sort of going to watch it. Yeah. And it's also there too. So yeah,
great, fantastic. Any questions so far? Yeah.
So, do you think that the reason why lawyers can't deal with things like CFP theorem is because the way in which they enact law is an outdated knowledge, or do you think it's just because the lawyers haven't caught on yet and that they should caught on?
So lawyers, generally speaking, view the world as being about interlocking human systems. There is a possibility that lawyers will learn how to interpret code bases as if they were bodies of law, and they'll understand the genealogy of a code base and the legacies embedded in it. They'll understand the sociological forces that produced it. They'll begin to understand that it is, in a sense, a set of opinions like legal opinions, right? Executable opinion. And if they manage to get that kind of hermeneutic grip on code, it's possible that we will see lawyers that are really able to get their head around code as a sociological phenomenon. But the fundamental problem is that the law is as complicated as smart human beings can make it, because you get competitive advantage from making it more complicated. So as a result, there simply aren't human beings with the cognitive capacity to master both law and code, because both systems are as complicated as they can possibly be. There might be a half a dozen people in the world that have the cognitive capacity to do both at a high level, but fundamentally each system is evolutionary and accelerationist. So with two systems that are both running absolutely at maximum capacity, it's extremely hard to find people that are interdisciplinary. It's a really, really, really tricky problem. All right, so let us wade in. All right, proud and GDP. This is going to be hard, right? Now, we have a model where we, generally speaking, govern by abstract principle, right? We establish a set of abstract principles, we obey the abstract principles, The abstract principles take form of things like the Ten Commandments. The problem is that the abstract principles assume that the laws of society, the equivalent of physical law, are constant across scales. So we have this idea that democracy is a good idea, and that democracy ought to work the same for a village of 150 people as it should for a continent of 750 million. Right? And in fact, nothing in nature, apart from very simple things, has that kind of linear scale. Right? Do you all know about the inverse square laws from things like biology? Square cube laws from biology. So if you have something like the width of your windpipe, the width of your windpipe varies as the square of your body size. But the surface of your lungs goes up as something like the cube of your body size. But no, wait, that's also square. What is cube? Cube would be your mass, right? So your mass goes up as the cube of your body size, but your windpipe only goes up as the square. So as a result, the larger an animal gets, the more of its body it has to devote to lung in order to be able to maintain the same kind of metabolic speed. In actual practice, that turns out to be too much lung, so large animals tend to be kind of slow. Right? Or they're like big cats, where they have enormous metabolic reserves, and when they go, they burn the metabolic reserves for a few minutes of furious activity, then they just run out of juice and they fall over. Crocodiles. So there are lots of things in nature which have this kind of property. Right? This, you know, one part of the system goes up as the square, another part of the system goes up as the cube or the fourth or the fifth power, and as a result, things don't scale. Right? The systems which work at a small scale, where the square has a big constant, it's bigger than the cube, then go through a phase transition, then at the big scale, the cube is a larger factor even though the constants are smaller. You see this a lot in algorithm design. Right, you know, big O notation, you've got an algorithm which is fast for a small data set, an algorithm which is large for a large data set. They've got different trade-offs. So the idea that societies can be governed by different mechanisms depending on the scale of the entity being worked with is completely foreign to current political discourse. The idea is that you establish a moral law and it is true from the top to the bottom, rather than establishing a pragmatic rule where in the small spaces you use one algorithm and in the large spaces you use another, and it might be four or five different algorithms that are efficient depending on the scale of the data set. The idea that you can use different principles for political governance depending on the scale of the unit that you're governing is basically unknown in a Western context, but not in India. There is this thing called progressive utilization theory, PROUT. And PROUT is cooked up by, I swear to God, an Indian political innovator who also runs a very large religious organization called Ananda Marg, the Path of Bliss. And this is a kind of hybridization where, like, Western cultures have this notion of law and religion as kind of separate, you know, power structures, and, you know, the parameterization of the space is different. So in an Indian context, it's relatively natural to have somebody present a macro theory of history using Sanskrit terminology yanked out of the Vedas, right? And to say that this makes the PROUT system illegible to Westerners is no understatement. I mean, there are books and books and books and books of translations of it. I think a good chunk of it might even have been written originally in English by Shankar, but at the end of the day, it is a supremely difficult to penetrate and illegible system for Westerners because it is axiomatically different at every level from Western computers, from Western political science. It's a completely different animal, but it does have this principle baked into it that you govern different things using different kinds of scale. So the basic nutshell summary is that they want natural monopolies to be state-owned, they want large enterprises to be employee-owned cooperatives, and they want small enterprises to run under more or less unrestricted capitalist free trade. Inside of a single society, as your company grows, more democracy to the workers, as it becomes so big that it begins to influence the whole of society, you simply move ownership to the state. Right. And on paper, that sounds relatively simple. To make it work, they then have to introduce a whole bunch of other abstract principles, like the idea that ordinary people are limited in the amount of wealth that they're allowed to accumulate. So as a private citizen, you can accumulate wealth for your basic needs and your family's basic needs for maybe three generations might be the equivalent of a few million pounds, but you are not legally entitled to accumulate wealth beyond that point. And it's only if you're being super productive for society that you're given a license to manage more wealth. Oh, Elon Musk, here, have a token that lets you manage $1 billion. But is that not enough? Here, have one for 10. So, the notion that you want to manage systems of different sizes using different algorithms is, you know, there are a couple of places where we see bits of it. One of those places is jury trials. Jury, 12 people, they make decisions about somebody else's liberty that are an integral part of our system of justice, and we pick random yahoos off the street for the job. But we insist that politicians have to be professional. And the political mechanism for just randomly selecting people to do the job is called sortition. And I think that sortition might have all kinds of interesting properties because it might correct some of the concentration of power issues that we see around the permanent political class. Now, these are extremely speculative notions. I'll get around to where the rubber meets the road in a moment. But I just want to hold out this notion that society is probably 10 times larger by count of human being and hundreds of thousands of times more complicated by number of products produced than it was when the original four-year electoral cycle was implemented. The idea that the scale that the democratic unit is at is one nation at a time, the nations have changed that law recognition since the early days of democracy. The America of 1776 and the America of today are so different in every matter of scale and speed, the idea that you're still using a four-year electoral democratic system to pick things seems kind of weird. It's literally the only thing that hasn't changed. No wonder it doesn't work. Imagine if we'd maintained, you know, 1776 transport while the rest of society modernized, but you weren't allowed to go on anything faster than a horse-drawn carriage because it was illegal. Because, damn it, that's the way we've always done transport. And that's how democracy is starting to look. And the failure of democracy to innovate is why you get states like Singapore and Dubai, which have incredibly efficient bureaucracies in a loosely authoritarian setting, and they produce incredibly high quality of life because at least their government works. Right? This lag in democracy comes from failure to adapt to a light-speed society, a failure to modernize democracy with every technology that increased the speed of society or gave us other options. And now we're in a position where the natural scale for almost any real innovation is global. Right? I put a bunch of software onto the internet. The natural deployment model for that software is it's available on the entire planet simultaneously at zero cost. And that's the natural mode. If I want to take it away from that natural mode, I have to put a whole bunch of additional crap into the software to stop it working outside the country I wrote it in. Or I have to do some even more ridiculous stuff to stop it working on computers for people that haven't paid for it. See what I'm saying? The natural mode of software is global and free. Everything else is artificially created by really hard work. So, governance by scale. If the natural mode of software is globally available and free, that's completely different to any kind of goods which have ever existed in society before. It even applies across language barriers, because actually, software will continue to work the same way without any translation at all if the software is, for example, purely visual or purely functional. Not purely functional in the technical sense, but if this piece of software wipes a hard drive, it will wipe the hard drive for a French speaker as easily as for a German speaker, as easily as for a Chinese speaker. So global, usable by any human being, free, as the natural mode of production when you make a piece of software, is completely unlike any other form of production that I can think of. Everything else is at least bounded by language groups and software can run right across them. So, how is it possible to govern something that has those attributes using horse-age machinery that was made for moving around donkeys covered in gold? Right. Doesn't work. There's no way you could do it. Software has therefore become an essentially non-democratic space because the democracies are very, very poor at making any kind of law that applies to software. And the result of being bad at passing laws which apply to software is that the software is basically ungoverned, apart from by the security apparatus, who are basically bureaucratically independent of the lawmaking machinery, and when software causes the problems, they kind of interfere with it. Like, I don't know, sabotaging your router so that you can read your email or whoever it happens to be. But this idea that the political contest over software is not carried out inside of the democracy because the democracy can't adapt to it, which leaves the secret state as the only arm of government that's savvy enough about software to be able to make policy decisions, kind of explains how we wound up with things like the Snoopers Charter. And it also explains why we're not seeing things like foreign policy by internet protocol, where some progressive state decides it's going to export its entire medical database and educational curriculum and farming system to other countries simply by writing manuals and publishing them on the internet, or by encapsulating those manuals as smartphone applications that ordinary people can use. Does this kind of make sense? Right? What if you've got an interface to the government, which was a smartphone in your pocket that gave you, you know, a diagnostic medical expert system that could be used in rural Africa as easily as it could be used in London? You know, you could extend the services of the state at zero marginal cost to the entire world. You might have to add a little bit of work on translation, you might have to do localization, or you happen to be in a malarial area, we'll put malaria into the database. Any government that exports its government services to the entire planet on that kind of basis is going to wind up providing governance services to billions of people at essentially zero marginal cost, and it will become a superpower. It could be Finland, it could be Switzerland, it could be Cuba. Any small country that's willing to automate most of its government service provision and then export it globally becomes a superpower, because you've got 2.5 billion people in poor countries using your software for making their everyday decisions about whether to send their kids to school or keep them at home and then take them to the doctor later. And the inability to think at that level is the dreadful legacy of this horse politics stuff. Because we couldn't export policy any further than we could march a bunch of horses with the amount of food that they could carry for themselves and the people riding them, that was the limit of the reach of a policy making unit. Right? You could garrison people at castles, but if the castles were too far away, eventually you'd lose control and you'd turn up and they wouldn't acknowledge your authority, so you end up with nation states of a particular size. The nation states which form later are larger because they've got railways and telegraph. That's why America is so big, it's why India is so big. The older nation states are tiny because that was the limit of the political authority, that's why Luxembourg and Belgium and so on are tiny. Roughly. Does this kind of make sense as a theory? Governance by scale. Old systems, slow communication, small states. New systems, fast communication, large states. In a light speed environment, what is the natural size of the state? Clearly the answer is global, right? And this is what the blockchain does. The natural deployment model for software is global and free. The blockchain is a global, free system for managing units of account, money. Gold that is managed for free and is out of the control of the nation states and can measure things like carbon if you load them into it. So the governance breakthrough of being able to provide accurate shared maps of reality that can be modified by anybody but you can't cheat them, which is another way of talking about what blockchains do, is the natural migration of authority to the level of global politics in an environment where the natural scale for any innovation is global and free. And this is a genuinely weird time. Why is Europe, many different countries, even though they are now operating in an environment where they've got rail networks and telecoms? This is what the entire fight about Brexit is about. Right? There's an attempt to redraw the European map to look like America, to look like China, to look like India, because the later countries are huge because they were formed at an age when you had continental level communication. So it's natural if Europe wants to modernize that it modernizes at a continental scale. The continental integration period is done. We basically have one government per continent apart from South America. Africa. Hardly any government at all in half of Africa. Right? But in Africa, the push towards Pan-Africanism has been fought by enormous amounts of violence and assassination for 50 years. That's why Africa is not essentially a single market, essentially a country. So we're now in a position where the logical scale is not defined by railways or road networks, the logical scale is defined by fiber optic cables and wireless and satellite. And that natural scale is global. What other services can you produce using software that are functional at a global level and are free? Education, healthcare, entertainment, farming advice, engineering for things like houses, maybe you can build your own water filters, More or less all the basic needs that a human being can have, in theory, you could be taught to do using software. And the mass coordination problems that are necessary to operate a global society, when you've got to do things like regulate carbon emissions, are potentially manageable with objective software, which is another way of saying blockchains, blockchains and post-blockchain instruments. The hard part about this is we can't do one human being, one vote until we've got some regular, solid way of distributing human beings from each other. Right. Final push. Is everybody basically with me? Does this sound completely insane yet? All right. Last part. I think I know how to get a global democracy started at affordable cost using current technology without breaking anything. Sound like fun? So here's how you do it. We have a blockchain. Bitcoin blockchain is probably just about good enough initially, but let's assume a kind of scale blockchain, post-blockchain universe. We've got a namespace for phones, which is the IMEI numbers, which are attached to the SIM. So suppose that I randomly select a telephone and call somebody. There's a decent chance that I can work with relatively simple direct approaches to select a random human being on the surface of the planet and phone. Now, you have problems like some places people own two phones, so if I own two telephones, am I twice as likely to get polled? Maybe we need some additional data to reduce that effect, but there's probably ways of doing it. I could probably look at the population of the area and the number of phones owned in the area, and I could compensate by that margin, right? If I know that the Finns have 3.5 handsets per person, then I call the Finns, you know, 3.5 times less than I call the people where you've got one handset per person. And I could basically statistically average it out, kind of sort of close enough. Reasonable? So if I can randomly phone somebody and I can figure out what language they speak from a bunch of additional cues like where the phone is, then I can ask them the question. And if they're willing to answer the question, I can log the call on a blockchain with a recording with all the metadata. And I could do that often enough that I got a statistically significant response to the question that I was asking. So if I call people and say, is the sky bright red, the color of blood, right? In all probability, I can get a statistically significant no from maybe 1,000 phone calls, right? Seem reasonable? So I randomly select a phone. It's statistically biased for the number of handsets. I call the person, I infer the language, I ask them the question, they give me an answer, I log up on a blockchain. I now have a statistical probe that lets me tell whether or not the sky is the colour of blood. No. Now I say, same question, right? Do you know what a birth control pill is? Yes. Should it be legal for a person to get them from a doctor? Of course. Click. And I make that phone call. And I discover that there are some areas of the world where the response is overwhelmingly no, but in most of the world the response is overwhelmingly yes. Or is it? I don't know what the answer would be if we asked that question globally. Right. I'm not sure. But it's an affordable cost question, because each phone call might cost us 5 or 10 cents. And so if I need 100,000 people to answer that question, it's going to cost me $10,000 to get the question answered with some statistical margin of error. And I've only had to bother an infinitesimally tiny percentage of the world's population, so we could ask these questions all the damn time, and we won't get fatigue from users having to answer 50 questions a day, because it'll be relatively infrequent to get these calls. You might get 3 or 4 of them in a lifetime, because we've got 7 billion person world, and 100,000 sample size is probably enough to answer any question to a reasonable degree of certainty. And we steer away from the questions which are very close to 50-50, because the actual information that you take out of a 50-50 situation is population is more or less evenly divided. But in the cases where you've got 80-20, 90-10 kind of answers, what you've got is a global political mandate generated by statistical means at affordable cost. And I think that this is the only political solution once worth floating in response to the current collapse of the international system around climate. I think we need to move to a light-speed global democracy that is fully native for our modern technology, and we need to start making decisions at that level as rapidly as possible to disenfranchise the horse lords and put the people that operate at the speed of light in charge of the future. because if we leave the horse guys in charge, we're well and truly screwed. And I think that is the bulk of the case. Right? I want to flesh out two little details about the electoral thing. So anybody could ask a question, and as long as they had the money to make the phone calls, they could continue to accumulate statistical data. And that could be funded by donation. So I start asking the question, and people pay additional money into that fund to make more of the phone calls. I think that could almost certainly be automated on a smart contract. First piece, smart contract that has the ability to raise telephone calls, reasonable, you need to accredit the translations and things like that, but it's all doable. Second thing is, if we do that, we wind up with a world which is going to be dominated by the opinions of poor brown and black people, because the average human being is a poor brown or black person. Also, it will be a society in which 50% of the responses are by women overall. So you might wind up, if you went to a full random sampling model, with an overwhelming transformation in our model of how the world actually is, because we'd be operating with a genuine random sampling base. And all of this, I think, is good. The one thing that I have some doubts about is whether you could ever make law this way, because at the end of the day, most of the people are insufficiently educated to understand the implications of complex legislation. And this is an unsolved problem. Right? How you turn global public opinion polling into actual legislation is an open question. I think the obvious answer is that we take the global public opinion data and then the nation states form political parties which will attempt to converge their legislation to it by degrees. So you can imagine, you know, a kind of Corbynista Labour Party that signs up to, we will attempt to approximate global public opinion on most policy issues except for the things where we have local cultural norms that they violate, and you gradually converge towards global governance on a regionalist basis. That's it. That's what I want. Thank you. Questions?
Yeah. In the scenario where you've got 10% who believe something different in a localized area,
yes.
Would you be against setting the law differently for those people in that area?
I don't know how to make law. I'm pretty sure we've got technical means to gauge global public opinion. Law for enclaves, I don't know how to do that. I don't really have an opinion on that yet, because you know that gets into a whole bunch of complex theory of justice stuff, and you know I can only do one thing at a time. Do you have thoughts on it yourself? Have a think, I'll take the next question and we'll come back. Yeah.
So actually I have two questions, if that's okay.
Sure. Ask one, then ask the other.
Okay. Sounds good. When I get to the end, I'll start at the beginning, and when I get to the end, I'll stop. First question is, when you say that when we think of a state as global,
yeah.
Are you referring to global as universal or as worldwide?
Worldwide.
Okay. The second question is, the goal is to manage the world's economies, as you were describing. Mm. It seems that there are two different motivations by which people are inclined to use these distributed ledger technologies. One of which is the operational optimization that you've described, which is the motivation to move from the horse world to the horse speed world to the light speed world.
Yeah.
And the second motivation is to have a way of indemnifying ourselves from these outcomes that might occur as the result of being mismanaged. So,
yeah.
For example, we have these currencies that are managed by poor speed economies. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to separate these two goals? And if so, how?
I'm not real sure that it's possible to separate them, because most of the clusterfuck is caused by, you know, the fundamentally problematic nature of horse speed decision making. So if you've got the horse speed decision making out of the situation, it might be that the mess just evaporates. Right? You know, mumble mumble, Bitcoin can't govern itself because they didn't build any democracy software into the software, so that's also a problem. I'm not sure. You had a question too?
Yeah, I have a question about this. You alluded a few times to a carbon credit distributed ledger system.
Yeah.
How do you link carbon emissions to credits, and who enforces it, if not centralized state?
So the way that I would approach that is,
we would figure out some way, said he, waving his hands in the air, of issuing tokens directly to each individual human being, and then that would be essentially a global basic income paid in carbon credits. And a global basic income paid in carbon credits is really easy to imagine because it doesn't cost anybody really any money at all to issue them. And then the value that they float at is dependent on a global market forming, which it probably will because the internet's everywhere.
But it stops you polluting if you don't have the...
Selling all my carbon credits and then burn a cardboard box and drive my limit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the way that you'd approach that is basically with drone strikes on large-scale emitters like power stations. You know, if you've got something that's belching out a gigaton of carbon a year, it's relatively easy to identify that installation, put a stop to it if you choose to. And that's the kind of violence that our modern nation states are really excellent at performing. You know, like breaking large-scale industrial infrastructure, we are past masters of that. Yeah.
So, we really might be spending a thought-provoking more of that. But it seems like you're approaching all of this in a pragmatic computer science sort of way.
Properly
technocratic. You can do everything in light speed and so on.
It's all very much kind of fun.
What sort of role would you give to... So one of the things you didn't really put into the equation is human psychology. So it's one set of attractors in the way we sort of put our society together is our technology and what limits that put. But another... attractor is kind of given by human psychology. So there's a lot of things we have, a lot of the ways in which society is, not because it's efficient or whatever, but just because people think it's fair, not that it necessarily maximizes efficiency. What sort of, when you talk about governance by scale, for example, I mean, one of the big up, there might be also for, you know, pragmatic reasons for that, probably.
Yeah.
But one of the big obstacles is probably that maybe people, you know, would feel inherently unfair if there was not kind of a single sort of moral whatever.
Yeah,
what sort of role do you give to that sort of human? Where does that fit into your equation?
I mean, given that we've got a billion people living in permanent hunger now, it's pretty clear that our human values are in fact completely irrelevant to our behaviours. Right? We do what's in our economic interests, and we will complain about the doing those things, more or less depending on the moral value, but it will not stop us doing them. So I think that generally speaking, if you move the economic base, there will be more or less complaining, but it will not change behavior very much based on people's moral sentiments. As far as I can tell, moral sentiments are basically just chrome, and economic interest is actually what motivates but action. And I'm not sure that that wasn't true in any society after the death of God. Like, there was a period when people were genuinely motivated by religion to do things that were against their economic best interests. But after you basically get atheism as a fundamental truth, most societies, even theoretically religious societies, stop acting on religious impulse. Like Americans, you know, used to give 10% of their income to the church as a regular thing pretty much over the entire continent. And even in areas where they will swear blind that the world is 4,000 years old, they still don't give that much money to their churches. So I think that there's been a fundamental shift where people are unwilling to act on the basis of their religion in most areas in a way that was not the case maybe 500 years ago. And that may be based on very shallow reading of history and modern sociology. I could be easily persuaded that I was wrong about that. But I think generally speaking, we've converged on the market as a driver, and things like religion and moral sentiment are just along for the ride behind it.
So what about sort of global movements towards more and more people becoming vegetarian and so on? Is that also because of their economic self-interest?
Meat's getting more expensive. And you know, a lot of these problems also are soluble in technology. Like, you know, we're probably on the last 10 years of farm animals, and we're probably on the last 10 years of coal mining. You know, I think that growing meat will turn out to take the world by storm. You know, vegetarians with their town down in Harvard. God, this stuff is great. Technology is getting close to the point of actually offering solutions. And we are going to go through, I think, a golden period where we get enough technology to solve the world's problems, but not so much that 5-year-olds can make artificial intelligences and then go destroy the world. You know, we'll get a 20-30-year golden period, and then I expect the apocalypse to be about 2045. You know, when we finally have so much power and we're still largely confined to one planet, oh, that would be bad.
But, you know, golden period, I fully expect the golden period to come in 8 to 12 years. 1 to 3 presidential terms. Solar will be so cheap, we've got abundant energy which will reinflate the economy, and the left will have cohered around basic income as a demand. Probably stuff is just going to kind of work its way out, but not yet. Sir?
How do you deal with apportioning scarce resources in a statistic example? This is like a round and round this. I think brilliant, this idea of reaching out to people rather than people reaching in to me to vote, because that's inherently self-selecting. Only some people will do it.
Yes.
And it's that's kind of one, that kind of solves one half of this riddle for me. But the other half is how you make these decisions where you have this, we only have so much resource. And we would all like everything to be excellent. We would like the perfect health system, perfect education system, and so on.
Absolutely.
It's, how do you, is there a way of building a system that allows those decisions to be made as well? To
no. at least not without deploying artificial intelligence.
Well,
right, and you know, you get into the kind of, you know, post-scarcity science fiction, like Ian Banks' culture stuff.
Yeah.
What's the guy, the Oculus guy? Palmer Luckey. Thank you. So Palmer Luckey says that he thinks that Oculus or virtual reality is absolutely necessary for human survival, because it brings the cost of crazy luxury experiences down to something that people could totally afford. Mm-hmm. Right. And I had a play with Google Earth VR this afternoon. I spent about 5 or 10 minutes in there because we're lucky enough to have an HTC Vive in the house. Whoa. Oh my God. It's amazing. I mean, it's just... it's the first VR application where I will preferentially spend time in VR 4 hours rather than doing something else, right? Because most of the VR content that I have right now, you know, Tilt Brush and you know, Quiver and all the rest of this kind of stuff, you could kind of fool around with for a while, but then pretty soon you begin to get kind of hungry for reality, right? And what they've done is they've taken the entire planet to like 30 centimeters of resolution or less and jammed it in to your goggles. You know, the Earth appears as a 40-meter wide sphere, and you could scroll over it, and then you could fly in. And, you know, like, I could tell the color of my neighbor's balconies. You know, my building wasn't constructed when they did the drone flyover, so I could see the diggers that actually built my house. I could see the slide for the kids to play on, and it's been rendered as a 3D object. It's jaw-dropping. So, you know, the cost of giving that experience to everybody in the world in 10 years will probably be $25 a human being. And at that point, I think you could see huge post-scarcity thinking in a whole bunch of areas in an environment where we're still short of food. And the hope is that we get post-scarcity in food production for biotech, because you just have these, you know, container-sized things with red and blue lights just churning out, you know, protein or whatever the heck it happens to be. But I don't know. I mean, the hard material scarcity stuff, God, I spent so much time on this. So look for a thing called simple critical infrastructure maps. Which is a bunch of planning, utility planning stuff that I did for managing this kind of scarcity and disaster situations. Mumble mumble, basic income, famines don't happen in areas where you've got an open market for food. I don't know, it's hard, right? The tech is going to go through a period of producing enough abundance to potentially fix these problems before it gets so good that we get replicator weaponry. And if we're smart...
It's a race.
It's a race, yeah. Right? And if we're smart, we push all the replicator engineering off to Mars and the dark side of the moon in cities that are built on top of large atomic weapons that we take out of, you know, the old arsenals. So if you wind up with a replicator incident, they just flash the city. I wrote a book about this, a quick hack sci-fi novella for National Novel Writing Month called Mother of Hydrogen. And Mother of Hydrogen is my take on a utopian future. Everybody else thinks it's a dystopia, but I think it's totally utopian. No, really seriously, I really think that it's a utopian future. It's the best credible future that I was able to imagine. And a lot of people read it and think it's totally grim. And I'm like, look, nobody is starving. Nobody is being arrested for their political beliefs. You know, people are free, and the people that want to live till 400 years old have to leave the planet because we won't let their nanotech-ridden bodies anywhere near the biosphere. This is fine. So, Mother Hydrogen. Right.
Couple more?
two more questions. All right.
Yes.
Hi, thank you for your talk. It was very powerful and thought-provoking. And I have a question which sort of addresses the first part where you talked about ideas of historical analysis, and you said something like, if blockchain works, we could escape history. So my question is asking, there's a premise that underlies the light speed and horse speed sort of dynamic,
mm-hmm.
and it's that horse speed can never catch up to light speed.
Yeah.
But the way I sort of got into blockchain was by seeing how horse speed structures are co-opting blockchain into their operations.
Yes.
So does that not undermine the potential for blockchain to be the basis of revolutionary change if that happens and it actually accelerates?
Sesame credit. Sesame credit, the Chinese government system for monitoring whether your citizens are okay or not okay. It'd be really logical for them to do it on the blockchain, and that would be the obvious way of doing it. So yes, every previous technology has been captured by the horse guys.
Right.
My friend Samari McCarthy and Herbert Snorrison did a talk at OHM 2013 where they discussed Kropotkin's vision of the electrical motor as the creating a decentralized liberal society in which people would have leisure and autonomy. And that turns out not to be what the electrical motor produced. And you know, the case that Samari and Herbert made was that, you know, basically internet activism is classical anarchism, and classical anarchism has always been technologically progressive and wrong. So, you know, we've got a shot at this stuff. Every previous generation has failed. I was not planning on failing, and I'm gonna see if I can not fail. But we've got to accept that every previous generation have largely failed to displace horse culture. That's why we still have four-year electoral terms. Right. Yes.
What exactly is so bad about four-year electoral terms and representative democracy in general?
Okay. The problem is that it is so slow that it is unable to react to threats like global warming for 30 years. Right. It's so primitive that you still have religious associations largely controlling access to the presidency and the Senate. It's impossible, right? You can elect a black man in a racist country, but you can't elect an atheist at any possible price. And all of that is being created by the massive concentration of power in the hands of tiny elected elites in ways which are just deeply pathological. Right. If you had something resembling direct democracy where people voted on policies rather than representatives, even people that are quite religious would in many cases have progressive beliefs about many issues, and overall you could get a consensus about what you were going to do that was not shaped by these religious factors. But having representatives focuses on personal identity as a huge part of the necessary precondition for political representation, and as a result it puts the same people in charge over and over and over and over again. The alternative approach is keep four-year electoral cycles in electoral democracy, but you execute all the MPs after one term. It's been done. I mean, there were societies that operated on some variation of that approach in Europe, right? The old Sun King thing. And I think that it has a lot to recommend.
You could also just use term limits, but sure.
No, term limits don't do it, because you always end up with just about the same class of people in charge. The idea that you have to fundamentally deplete that class so you don't have to worry about them becoming lobbyists, and eventually you take the genes out of the gene pool. It might take 500 years, but we've had democracy for quite a long time. I mean, you know, I'm willing to examine almost anything at this point. But I think you know, global telephone democracy is a much better thing than executing our MPs after they serve a term. I'm willing to be persuaded in almost any direction that looks like a solution, because we really need one. You know, this has gone far enough. We can't have nuclear weapons run by horse people. We just can't do it. It doesn't make any sense. But imagine what the Star Trek Enterprise guys would have done if they'd come to this planet and they had a license to interfere. You know? Spock, we can't possibly allow this to go on. They're covered their planet in nuclear weapons. At any moment, they could start a nuclear war and kill everything on that orb. We must do something, right? You know, they would view this as a planet in imminent danger of total destruction at all times, because we've got all these, you know, automated systems and nukes attached, and then we elect lunatics to manage them. They'd view it as a position of clear and present interventionism. You know, screw the Prime Directive, we must save these people. Why? turned up, I don't know, but I'm getting kind of impatient.
Okay. So just as an idea, maybe we should take this discussion to the pub.
Yes.
Fly.
Sold. Okay. Good. Lovely.
Thank you.